Okay, the Noble Eightfold Path was the Buddha's first teaching and his very last teaching. In the very first discourse that he gave, he talked about the Eightfold Path as the main topic. And the last student that he had, he taught the Eightfold Path too as well. So the Eightfold Path forms the framework for all of his teachings, the context for everything else. So if you want to understand anything else the Buddha taught, you have to see where does it fit in the path. So this is going to be giving you the framework. In his very first sermon, he described the Noble Eightfold Path as a middle way composed of eight right factors that lead to the end of suffering, or dukkha in Pali, which can mean suffering, or we can also translate it as stress. And it also leads to nibbana. Nibbana means unbinding. And it relates to the image that they had of fire back in the Buddha's time. But when a fire was burning, it was agitated and clinging. And when it let go, it would go out. That's when the fire went out, they actually saw that the fire let go. And then it was freed from its fuel. So the implication is that this path is one that leads to calm and to freedom in the ultimate sense. It's good to think about the implications of what it means when the Buddha takes a path as the framework for his teachings. There's a sutta in Majjhima 12 where he makes the point that everybody is on a path of one sort or another. Lots of different, our actions lead to results. For most of us, it leads to simply more aging, illness, and death, and what the Buddha calls samsara, which is means the wandering on, this process of which you keep going to a new place, to a new place, to a new place, over and over again. We actually create the worlds into which we move, and this means worlds both in the physical sense and in the mental sense. Once we've created this world in our imagination, then we go into it, and that's how we're born. This process of creation is driven by desire. In fact, the Buddha said all of our experience is rooted in desire, the desire to go someplace. But because that desire is conditioned by ignorance, we often get results that we don't really desire, don't even anticipate, or even want. This falls in line with the fact that not all paths lead to the top of the mountain. If you've ever been on a mountain, you know that some paths lead to the top, other paths lead to a drop-off, other paths lead back down to the bottom. And the Buddha actually makes this analogy in this sutta that I was talking about, Majjhima 12. He says there's a path that goes to a pit of glowing embers, which is, he says, is the path that goes to the various hells that people can create for themselves. There's the path that goes to a cesspool, which is the animal realm. There's a path that grows to a tree growing on uneven ground with scanty foliage, providing just a little bit of shade. This is the path leading to the realm of the hungry ghosts. There's a path leading to a tree growing on even ground with lush foliage that provides dense shade. That's a path leading to rebirth in the human realm. There's a path that leads to a palace, which is the heavenly realms. And then there's a path that leads to a lotus pond with pristine water, pleasing water, cool water, with restful banks, refreshing, and not far from it is a dense forest grove. And this is his image for the path that leads to nirvana. In other words, that's his image for the Eightfold Path. The Buddha's desire and teaching was to provide us with a path of right view so that we can follow a map of right view so we can follow the path that will lead to the end of suffering. Now, because our views determine our actions, the map is actually going to be part of the path. This is why right view is the first factor in the Eightfold Path. Now, this right view has to give you enough information to orient you as to where you want to go, what you have to watch out for. You don't want too much information, because otherwise that would get in the way of seeing clearly where you need to go. Think of a map to a fire escape in a building. All you want to know is, where are you right now? What's the route to get out of the building? You don't need to know who designed the building, who built the building, whether the building was made out of brick or stone or wood. You don't need to know all the rooms in the building. All you need to know is where you are, how to get out. And that's precisely what the Buddha provided in right view. He didn't give all the information about reality, but he said, here's where we are in a place of suffering. This is how we can get out. That's what right view provides. Now, the purpose of a map is, proper use of a map, is something that you follow. You don't just sit around and talk about it or argue about it. You actually follow the steps that are shown in the map. This way, right view itself is a means to an end. We're not trying to arrive at right view. We're actually going to be using right view to take us beyond right view. This is the proper way to approach the questions of what the Buddha taught and how to interpret them. But the map here, in this case, we'll have to provide is an explanation of action. As the Buddha said, we suffer because of our actions, but we can also get out of suffering through our actions when we make them more skillful. And so he will have to explain what is the nature of action, what is the principle of cause and effect, and how far those effects can go. This is why mundane right view, which is the first level of right view, talks about issues of karma, the power of action, and also issues of rebirth, having to deal with what can be created through our actions, not only in this lifetime, but also in lifetimes going on into the future. This map the Buddha is going to provide also has to explain why it is useful or desirable to go to the end of suffering and what it would mean to do that. Has to talk about the dangers that we have to avoid in our existence. And here he talks about the Buddha talks about the way our existence is fabricated through our intentions and through our will. The things we experience are not just things coming at us. We have raw material, but also we have our intentions that shape that raw material into our actual experiences. The Buddha talks about three ways in which we do this. There's bodily fabrication, verbal fabrication, and mental fabrication. Bodily fabrication is the way you breathe. The way you breathe is going to have an impact on the way you are experiencing the world around you. Verbal fabrication is essentially the way you talk to yourself about things. Something comes up and you have comments prepared already to decide what's interesting, what's not interesting, what's important, what's not important, what's desirable, what is not desirable. And this will shape the way you actually have an experience. And finally, mental fabrication has to do with your feelings and perceptions. Feelings here means feeling tones of taking pleasure, pain, neither pleasure nor pain. If you're in a lot of pain, then things that you otherwise might like are suddenly going to be disagreeable. If you have a feeling of pleasure inside, then things that might be disagreeable could actually be easy to stand. And then there's the power of perception, the labels that we place on things. And this immediately has a lot to do with our culture and our background, but you put two people in one situation and they will perceive different things, and then as a result, they will have totally different experiences. So these are the ways in which we fashion our experience, bodily, through the way we breathe, verbally, through the way we talk to ourselves, mentally, through our perceptions and feelings. I'll give you an example from last night. There was this little animal over here while we were meditating. It was going, wah, 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 wah. Remember? And at first I thought it was a dog. And I said, what a stupid dog. And then I realized, no, it's not a dog, it's a frog. That's okay, it's okay, frogs do that. So the perception, the labels that you apply to things are going to change the way you experience them. I can think of another example. A friend of mine was teaching in Korea. She was teaching English. And before she went to Korea, she took pictures of life in the United States and then made slides to show to the students. And she was showing them a restaurant, and there was a little dispenser. It was a straw dispenser where you could press the button and a little straw would come out that you could use to drink. And she pointed this to the students, you know, what do you think this is? And the students' eyes lit up. So, chopstick dispenser. That was the perception that they would apply to things. So it shows that our perceptions and the way we talk to ourselves play a huge role in what we actually see and hear. Now the problem with this process of fabrication is something that's put together like this falls apart. Everything that is put together through our intentions will fall apart. And the Buddha is saying this involves stress and just trying to keep things going all the time. And we're trying to find something that will lead to what is not fabricated. We'll talk about this in a minute. On top of that, there's a problem that we are trying to feed off of these things that we have put together. It's as if we get raw material together to fabricate it, to feed off of. And the Buddha says this act of feeding, which is also the same word for clinging in Pali, is his definition of stress and suffering. It's because we try to feed off things that we have created. And the fact of the act of feeding itself is something that is stressful, because we've taken on an identity which then requires food. There are four kinds of clinging or feeding in the way we define ourselves. We'll talk about this in more detail in another day, but they're basically, we cling to sensuality, which is our way of being fascinated with thinking about sensual pleasures and planning for sensual pleasures. We cling to our views about the world. This has to be this way, that has to be that way. We cling to habits and practices, whether things have to be done a certain way. And also we cling to ideas of who we are or what we are, and that's clinging to ideas of self. And as the Buddha points out, that whatever you cling to, whether it is permanent or not, is going to be suffering, because the act of clinging in and of itself requires a lot of tension and a lot of fabrication in order to keep it going. So that's the Buddha's definition of suffering, which also means that the end of suffering will have to be something that is not fabricated, and that's nirvana. The path, as I said, is something that leads to what is unfabricated, but the problem is you cannot use anything unfabricated as a path, which means that you have to fabricate the path. In other words, you will be putting it together through the way you breathe, the way you talk to yourself, through your perceptions and feelings. You put it together in such a way that the path will lead you to the unfabricated. Now, it's important to realize the path does not cause the unfabricated. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha uses the image of a path. It's like a path going to a mountain. The mountain is there independent of the path. The path does not cause the mountain, but the path can take you there. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha used the image of the path. There's an analogy that's often used in the canon of a raft. The raft takes you across to the other side of the river. Once you got to the other side, you can let go of the raft because you've reached a place of safety. But until then, as long as you're crossing the river, you have to hold on to the raft. And this is what we're going to be putting together as we practice the Eightfold Path. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha calls the path noble, is because it does lead to something that is not fabricated. The word noble in Pali has several meanings that are important to understand. The first has to relate to what the Buddha makes, the distinction the Buddha makes between a noble path and a path that is not noble. A path that is not noble leads to a happiness that is subject to aging, illness, and death. In other words, you gain something, but it's not going to stay with you. It will fall apart. A noble path is one that takes you to something that is free from aging, free from illness, free from death. This is why the Eightfold Path is called a noble Eightfold Path. The word noble also means preeminent, in other words, that this is a path that is the most important path that you could follow. It is virtuous, it causes no harm to anyone at all, and it develops, requires good qualities of character, good qualities of the heart, good qualities of the mind in order to follow. We'll be talking about some of those this evening. It's a path that is deserving of respect, and also the word noble in Pali means that it's universal, it's true for everybody. It's as true here in the middle of Brazil now as it was for the Buddha in India 2,600 years ago. The Buddha also called, in his first sermon, he called the path a middle way. Now this, he says, is a middle way between sensual pleasures and a middle way between self-torture. Now this does not mean that it's a middling, neutral feeling that we're trying to create. Rather, the path is one where we use pleasure and we use pain as in line with the rules of karma, causes and effects. In other words, they have to come from skillful actions and they have to lead to desirable results. The consequences must have a good effect on the mind. And then if it's a pain or pleasure of that sort, then you can use it. I'll give you some examples. There's what they call pleasures and pains not of the flesh, as opposed to sensual pleasures, which are pleasures of the flesh. There's the pleasure of right concentration, where you get the mind to settle down, be still, have a sense of ease, well-being, and rapture. We make use of that, even though it can be a very intense pleasure that comes with this. It's still part of the middle way, because we're using it for a higher purpose. There's also what the Buddha calls pain, not of the flesh. And that's the pain of realizing that you have a goal, but you haven't reached the goal yet. And there's a kind of a mental pain that goes along with that. But the Buddha doesn't say to just abandon your goals. He says instead, use that as a motivation to make further progress on the path. So you actually use that pain as a motivation to give yourself strength on the path. There are also good pleasures of the flesh. There's the pleasures of being out in nature like this, where you're not being subjected to all the sights and sounds and smells of the city. This is a pleasure that is very conducive to getting the mind more calm. Seclusion is also a useful pleasure of the flesh. You have time to be alone and time to consider your life and put things into perspective and not be constantly pushed around by the agendas of other people. There's also the pleasure of social harmony. When a group gets together like this and we behave in ways that are harmonious, that is actually also a help on the path. So we look around us and see what kind of pleasures are useful in getting the mind into the right frame of mind in order to practice, that are conducive to the practice. We use those pleasures. We don't deny pleasure. But there are also pains that we can use as well that can be helpful in further motivating us to continue with the practice. So those are some of the things we learned from the Buddha's first talk on the right Noble Eightfold Path. It is noble in the sense that it leads to an unfabricated pleasure. It leads to the end of suffering as a result. And it is also a middle way that makes use of pleasures and pains in order to get to an unfabricated pleasure. Now, in terms of the Buddha's last talk on the Eightfold Path, right before he died, there was a wanderer from another sect who came and visited him and said, I want to know, is everybody out there who talks about enlightenment, are they all enlightened or none of them enlightened or some of them? And the Buddha said, put that question aside. He said, I'll teach you the Dharma. And then he went on to say that in any teaching where you find the Noble Eightfold Path, you will find enlightened or awakened people. If there's no Eightfold Path, then there's nobody going to be awakened. And so he says, basically, this is the only right path. This is what we mean when we say there's right view, right resolve, right effort, all the way down through right concentration. Now, these things are right not because the Buddha said they were right, because he said that these are the only things that work. The example he gives is trying to get milk out of a cow. If you twist the horn of the cow, then no matter how hard you twist, no matter how ingenious you are in twisting, you're not going to get milk out of the cow. You're going to harass the cow as well. But if you pull on the udder of the cow, you get the milk. So it's just the way things are. It's not because the Buddha said these were right, but this is the only thing that works. For him, what works is that you want to put in the effort that will actually lead to the results that you want, which are the end of suffering. Now, some people say we should follow a path of no effort at all. Just sort of relax, and everything will be okay. Well, that's like saying, I've been twisting the horn of the cow all day, and no milk comes out. I'm tired of twisting the horn. I will stop twisting the horn. I'll be okay. Okay, you're relaxed, and the cow is not being harassed, but you're not getting any milk. There is a certain effort that has to go into getting the milk out of the cow, in the same way there's a certain effort that has to go into the path, so we actually get to a result which is not fabricated, and which, once it is attained, will not require any more effort at all.